Welcome to Blind Shovel, an arts and music podcast. Today I speak with publisher and curator Dan Nadell. Hope you enjoy.
Hello.
Hello.
What's up?
Not much.
Hey, yeah. Good to meet you.
Good to meet you. Yes, I know. It's funny we haven't met before, actually, but here we are.
Yep. So what's this museum you're working at now? The Museum of Narrative Art.
The Lucas Museum of Narrative Art is opening in a couple of years, and it is a museum that George Lucas and Melody Hobson have founded that is dedicated to narrative art, which is defined as or encompasses comics and illustration and cinema and murals, all sorts of painting and drawing, even sculpture. So, but you know, it's geared towards artwork that tells a story. So,
right.
It's been a project of Lucas's for a long time, and it's I started last June, and it's been good. It's been really good.
I had no idea he was. I'm always curious what he's going to do with all that money. So that's cool. That sounds like an awesome project, actually.
Yeah, it's great. It's been super interesting, and he. The collection is really deep and full of really great nuggets, so I'm excited.
Where's that going to be based out of?
It'll be, it's already under construction. It'll be in Los Angeles down by USC in an exposition park.
Interesting. And so your role in that is, I see it's curator at large, is that correct?
Yeah.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
It's a good question. Usually curators at large, generally it means that we don't live where the museum is. So I live in Brooklyn, and I'm not moving to LA for at least the foreseeable future. And that's the at large part.
Oh, I never knew that.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a full-time gig. It would be pretty hard to be full-time remote, so it's a partial gig remote, which works nicely, actually.
So besides that, what do you got going on currently?
Besides that, I am I'm just finishing up my biography of Robert Crumb, which will come out in a year, I think, a little over a year from Scribner. And I'm also a co-curator of a project at the Whitney Museum that's rethinking the art history of the 1960s through the lens of surrealism. And that opens in the fall of 2025. These are just projects that have been going for a long time, but are sort of coming to a head. So it's exciting. And then, you know, scattered essays here and there and that kind of thing. I mean, work-wise, yeah, that's
right on. What is left to be said about Crumb? I'm curious. I'm not saying that to be a dick. I'm just thinking, like, how many movies are out there about Crumb? Is there two?
One. There's just the one.
Oh, just that one. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Without giving away spoilers, no. I think there's a lot to be said. I think most of 20th century vernacular drawing goes into him, and then he impacts or deeply influences most of what came after him, including contemporary art. So there's a lot to unpack there. He is a fascinating guy, and I think the public kind of perception tends towards the grotesque or the lurid, and there's a lot more there than that. And he's been great. I mean, you know, spending this much time with him has been wonderful.
Yeah, that makes sense. I realized when I said that question, I like assumed I knew who he was because the comics are.
He's not that guy.
Yeah, exactly.
He's a very. I mean, you know, obviously part of him is that guy, but there's the Crumb I'm meeting is of course, given his age, very different from the Crumb of the 1970s or 60s or 80s. So. It's been really interesting.
It sounds like you got a great diet going in terms of projects.
Yeah, it's a good diet. It's a little high stress, but it's otherwise balanced. It's all right.
Yeah. Were you balancing this many plates when you were doing Picturebox, or were you just focused on that as a publishing entity?
I was... also balancing other things. All through Picturebox, I wrote books, and I mean nothing like the Crumb book, but Picturebox, like Art at a Time and mm-hmm. things like that. And yeah, I did a lot of visual books on the side of Picturebox, and a lot of writing. Not as much curating, that's for sure. That sort of kicked in more after Picturebox. Although I did some things during. It was easier during the Picturebox years to think about other books that needed to be elsewhere or essays that felt particularly important to me for. God knows what reason. And I had an outlet with Comics, and then the Comics Journal. It was sort of fast and easy and fun. So I guess, yeah, I'm a bit of a workaholic, I guess. I just like to work.
I mean, if you enjoy it, I think that's completely acceptable. You know, it's weird when people are workaholics and they do something really corporate and horrible. That I don't find acceptable, but I relate to if you like doing what you're doing, of course you want to do it more.
Yes.
You know, there's life and you have a family, etc. So like yes, those things need to be balanced. But I'm kind of curious to understand the evolution. Is it fair to say that you've become more institutionally involved over time? Or, and by that I mean like working with big museums and whatnot, yeah, or have you always? Yeah,
that's fair. That's a reasonable thing to say, sure.
And how has your view of institutions over time changed? Were you critical of them when you were younger?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, it's funny. I was like critical of them. Sure, but... I grew up going to museums, and I mean, in particular, the National Gallery of Art in DC, and I loved it. And so for most of my life, I had a pretty uncritical love of museums. And that, you know, that changed in my 20s. But I don't, each institution is so unique. Each institution is different, and I've been allowed and invited to do such great things that while I, you know, I'm probably, now that I'm involved, I'm much more critical, but I still give a lot of leeway because it's art. It's not, you know, I'm not somebody that, what am I trying to say? I'm critical to a point, but I give a lot of leeway because they're very human places despite their issues. There's sort of a general public good that supersedes, to my mind, a lot of the problems that are inherent in art museums.
Gotcha. No, I kind of asked because comics can be so often... highly individualistic and isolated.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to see them, or even like this Museum of Narrative Art looks like a very interesting project. That's not something I would expect from a museum.
Yeah.
And I don't know, there can be also the thread of anti-establishment or anti-institution within comics, but also
yes,
even you're presenting an alternate narrative from largely, I think, the institutions, right? In the sense of like, this is a different way we could have been looking at art history if only absolutely presented that differently.
Yeah, yeah. And what's interesting is you get into these places and everybody has a point of view. And it's interesting. I mean, I've always been, I'm leery of kind of knee-jerk snobbery and knee-jerk reverse snobbery. So I don't,
yeah.
I'm not that interested in the sort of comics guy thing of, you know, Roy Lichtenstein, blah, blah, blah. That doesn't interest me, and neither does the sort of modernist curator thing of, you know, comics, low culture, blah, blah, blah. Neither of those is really tenable. So I think it's always struck me, and I think particularly when I started writing a lot, that you had to find a middle way. And there are artists that have been thinking about it for decades, of course. And it has taken museums a long time to catch up. And there, I think it's going to still take longer. And that is a function of all the things you would imagine, like market and taste. And that's also interestingly, maybe the not the most interesting, but at least kind of interesting to me, is sort of like people don't know what comic art objects what a comic art object is. Like, is it a drawing, or is it a drawing for a print? Is it a working drawing? Is it, what do you even hang it next to? And like, that's the sort of stuff that can be rewarding to discuss, because it's a matter of making someone understand that it's not that different than, you know, a Klaus Oldenburg drawing for a sculpture, or it's not that different from, I don't know, name your Raymond Pettibone drawing. Like, you know, it's all there already. You just have to kind of attach it. But I don't know where I was going with that. But I guess the Lucas is the first major swing at establishing a history and a kind of theory of how these things might connect. I mean, obviously there's the Norman Rockwell Museum, and which is a lovely place. But that's really mostly illustration. So
different. Yeah, it's very interesting to have something so broad like narrative art.
I know.
You know, I went to school for illustration, and I don't think I knew what it was, and I don't think I do even now in hindsight. But yeah. I ended up being channeled through some very specific things that I didn't ultimately want to do, like editorial illustration. Sure. You know, for me as a young child, I just saw pictures and books, and I liked reading books and I liked the pictures. So I was like, oh, this is the ultimate fusion of whatever impulse I had. And dividing it, you know, like you can say sequential art, narrative art, etc. But there's something interesting about the word or the phrase narrative art that I don't think I've ever seen a museum have in its title.
No, this, I think this is the first. And it's very much like, you know, it's very much a vision of, well, how do we bind these things together? What do they all have in common? You know, what does Norman Rockwell have in common with Winsor McKay and Diego Rivera and, you know, and Star Wars? It's all narrative. So
it's a huge, huge category. I'm curious to see how things get like hemmed in a bit. And I'm looking at the website, and it's quite fascinating to see what's being positioned next to each other.
Yes. Yes. And that, yeah.
And would that be your, trying to understand, especially since you are at large, what is the daily involvement in a sense with something like this?
Daily involvement is, you know, it's a good curatorial team, and I'm working on upcoming exhibition ideas, collection rotations, mostly in comics and children's book illustration right now.
That's cool.
And so daily, it's a lot of work in PowerPoint and a lot of research, because I'm also writing texts for, you know, texts that will be variously used as you know, a potential object label or something for a collection book or something for the website. So it's a kind of, it's triaging basically. And then a few, 3 or 4 meetings a week, probably on Zoom with the team and or individual meetings. So it's a mix. It's a lot of putting things next to each other, which is fun. You know?
Yes.
And combing through the collection database and pulling things together, trying to make pairings, make rooms, make themes, and in some cases identify objects that came in a long time ago that might not have proper attribution. So it's that kind of work. It's funny, like you said, increased institutional stuff. It's a very, very different headspace than writing, which is also a very different headspace than Picture Box was. They're all kind of unique spaces. So, but the institution thing, I think it really happened because on some level, people needed somebody who could talk about this, like on the one hand, the Harry Who, but in a contemporary and modern art context, things like the Harry Who, I should say. And I think that's, and institutions have sort of caught on to that world. And because I've done enough curating now and writing, there's only a few of us who can operate in both worlds.
Right.
And so that I think that's probably why the institutional things happen. And also, you know, in comics proper, whatever that is, there's, as you know, extremely minimal infrastructure. There's Ohio State, which is amazing as a research space. And, you know, then you can apply for grants. But there's very little otherwise. So for me, it's been extremely helpful just in making a living and broadening my own thinking. You know, I kind of need that kind of brain food to just keep thinking, to keep expanding.
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense. And I'm kind of curious about the evolution from, I don't even know why you started Picture Box or how it came about or at what age you did it, but yeah. I'm trying to understand psychologically where you were, like, did you ever want to be an artist? Or were you always in this kind of editor curatorial position in respect to the arts? Or what is that? I don't know. It's interesting. Often I'm talking to these artists about, you know, when they were 5, they were drawing a lot, or there's this very clear imprint when they're young. Right. So I'm always interested in, like, how did you know, or did you know, that this path made sense? Obviously, you've been on it a long time and it's come to fruition, but what was that evolution like?
That's a big one.
it's huge, but
let's see. Yeah. No, I was totally obsessed with comics as a kid, as you might imagine. Like really obsessed, both collecting and reading and going to the comic store every week and going to the library and just completely going deep on comics history really young. The Smithsonian books were at the local library, so I read those over and over again. And Jules Feiffer's book was there, and I very early on I fixated on that kind of encyclopedic knowledge. And I can remember alienating like my then best friend by insisting on quizzing him on the X-Men's individual powers. Really, really annoying stuff. But I kind of, pretty young, got onto Mouse, and then from there, American Splendor, and from there, Crumb, like maybe in seventh or eighth grade. And it just, the whole comics just blew out my mind. And each, as I found new things, it kind of kept opening doors in my head. And once I got into high school, it sort of seemed like, well, there must be related art to this somehow. And so I started finding that kind of stuff. And I've always been friends with artists. I did try and like make comics when I was, geez, maybe 10 or 11 or something like that. And I took a bunch of art classes in college, but I knew when I was a freshman in college and I met like really serious artists, like the guy I started the Gonsfeld with, Patrick Smith, I knew I wasn't one of those. Like I just, it was very clear.
In what sense? Not temperament, but like, what were you? Because like, I've met people who aren't amazing in terms of talent, quote unquote, but they obviously have some kind of push or determination to just find themselves through that process.
I could tell that the things that they were thinking about artistically and their skills were of such a different order of magnitude than mine, that there was no point. Like, I didn't want to be mediocre. And I don't have the temperament to sort of slog away at something I know I'm just not that good at. I mean, not that I'm so secure or anything that I, in what I do, but when it's really apparent to me, it's just there, and it's sort of silly to continue. And I found that I really like talking to artists. I learned so much, and it's still kind of like, it sounds so cheesy, but it's still kind of magical to me as it was then. So pretty early on, maybe even in college, I started thinking like, what's a way I can participate without being an artist? And there's so many examples of that readily available, like Raw and magazines like that, Drawn and Quarterly, that it just seemed right there. So that, you know, it's always been artists. And when I think about how I learned art history, it's really through, I mean, I learned comics history through the comic book store and through the Comics Journal. And that is really about reading interviews with people like Seth or their Hernandez brothers or Klaus, you know, all these people, Burns. And then getting to New York, I sought out people I admired and in some cases became really close friends and learned even more. So I find that artists and cartoonists have always had to make their own history, and cartoonists especially, because there was no canon. There still is no canon. And so they're just ready to talk, and I love to be involved in those conversations. But yeah, I knew I had to be involved somehow. That was really the impetus for, I didn't know what the hell else to do.
No, that makes complete sense, but it's also interesting for me to consider not the starving artist trope, but someone who's just really, really interested in the arts
right,
trope.
Right.
And because I'm sure, yeah. surely you weren't. Was Picture Box your first serious go at like a somewhat financially viable thing?
Emphasis on somewhat. Yes. Yeah, it was. With a couple friends from college, I started the Gonsfeld in 99, and we published the first one in 2000. They left after that one. And then I continued on with a business partner who was also the art director at the time. And after a couple issues, he left. And it's a pattern. And I decided, childhood was this magazine that was meant to include all my interests. And it was very much inspired, not in content or even in form, but just in being able to exist. It was inspired by McSweeney's, which I can't remember how old you are, but like in the late 90s, that was the thing. Like 99, yeah. 2000, like 98, 99, 2000, 2001. It seemed like it was taking over culture. And now it's vanished pretty much from culture, which is fascinating to think about. Taking with it many of its star writers and a whole aesthetic, really. It's funny. That's a whole other tangent. But the Gonsfeld was like, oh, yeah, this is a thing you can do. Because I'd read about Dave Eggers doing it from his apartment and all that kind of jazz. So I did that, and then I just wanted to publish books. And I had this idea to publish a book with the band Wilco, which I did, a kind of Gonsfeld with a band. And that did extremely well. So much so that it financed the next few years of Picture Box, essentially. And that led to being able to do the Paper Rat book. And, I've always tried to look for where the gaps are. And, you know, there's like the things I love and the things that aren't being done. And it's when those two meet that I do a project. And I'm like, there's no point doing something that's been done. And for me, because I'm a nut about being sort of personally excited about the thing. And so Picture Box came out of that. It was like, okay, well, I love Paper Rat. I love what's happening in Providence. Nobody is touching this stuff. High Water Books was gone at that time, or was going. And I knew that this stuff had to be out there. It just had to be. It was so fucking great. It still is. It still holds up so well. And I loved it. And I loved the people involved. And so it was just fun. I mean, it was really hard work, but really fun. And really exciting to be a part of. It felt like, oh, yeah, this is the Harry Who, or, oh yeah, this is Gary Panter in 1979, like, and I'm here, and I get to be a part of it. It was great.
And what age were you during that whole Picture Box run, roughly speaking?
11.
11. Just a young boy.
Extremely precocious. I was born in 1976, so I was 23 when I started.
Okay, that makes total sense. I mean, as I'm 35 and I'm just beginning to understand the way, and I think this is a good thing, people evolve in terms of what they take on project-wise.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, it seems to me apparent you could never flip these things around, and they're there for a very specific reason. And like you said, yeah. It seemed like you were motivated by the intersection of what moved you and what wasn't being talked about. I'm sure now you have more metrics you need to insert into that, you know, like you have a family, correct? So like
you need to
think that through.
Yeah.
And I think all those things can be done with integrity. I don't like this idea that, like, this is the death knell once you turn 30 or something, and you have to actually be pragmatic, you know?
You have to be a little more pragmatic, or a lot more. But that doesn't... I mean, if that was the death knell, we wouldn't have so much great stuff. It's just you adjust. And I've tried to adopt something where I there are certain projects I know I'm just never going to make any money from, and I love them and I do them anyway, but it just means I have to do some other things a little extra, or write some press releases for money, or, you know, just do some things that I might not otherwise do. And that's okay. It's worth it. It's like the Peter Saul letters book that I did, like that. It needed to exist. And so it does, and that will always, I don't see that balance changing. I hope it doesn't. I've been lucky that I can have like these steady things, like the Whitney and the Lucas, and I'll get an advance on a book or whatever. There's a sort of baseline that I can maintain. And because I really, there's certain things that I can do fairly naturally, and putting books together is kind of that thing in particular. I just kind of know how they work without sounding like grandiose, but I had a lot of practice, and I love it. And I it's all very enjoyable.
Oh yeah, something very magical about books.
Yeah.
Then there always will be. I don't know if it'll always be recognized, but essentially, I think there's something about them.
Yeah, I don't even care about the recognition. Like, I just, yeah, it may not be recognized, although it feels like it is. I don't know.
Well, I'm hesitant to go down this rabbit hole, but it relates to the
e-books.
No. Yeah, I want to. it seems to me that the editor, the curator, that kind of mindset, it might become the dominant one as AI produces a heap of visual nonsense and imagery, where like there's more just like this corralling of this thing with like these prompts and whatnot. And it's interesting to me, like, I think editing is already a huge part of being an artist, a very big part.
Absolutely.
But in respect to books being recognized as magical objects, obviously every religion is centered around a book, so I think there's good reason to think they will remain. But, you know, even as I'm working on newer books, I have a different way of seeing it, where I'm like, I should probably get back to drawing on a piece of paper, just so, like, when I wake up in 30 years, I knew I actually drew it. And my kids knew I drew it, as opposed to I just imagine this like endless heap of, not like, I don't even know how we're going to sort through it. And it's part of what's interesting to me about, this may seem like a non sequitur, but if someone was listening to this ignorantly of what you do, they would hear a guy who's really into comics, and they would see like this kind of specific curation, I think, that wouldn't be very representative of what you do. So I think there's some very clear, and I hesitate to call it an algorithm, but there's some clear value set that you have that is very specific curatorially, that isn't just like, for instance, these institutions aren't coming to some fat comic book nerd guy and saying, we need you to curate this show. So during that transition away from just being obsessed with comics, which I assume, I don't know the type of aesthetic, but I'm sure it was different than what was occurring in Rhode Island at the time. How do you even explain what you're into? Because like, even there's a relative notion about an outsider, because once the outsider's in, then they cease to be.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally. I hesitate to even, I mean, I know what the algorithm would tell you. Yes, absolutely. Cartoony figuration with sort of some grotesque elements, something like that would be the line. I am really not, I'm someone that can talk very specifically for a long time about individual artworks or artists or movements. But when it comes time to zoom out and explain what it is I'm into, I basically can't. I mean, I can, or maybe I can't. I try not to. It's like when people say, well, what were you up to today? I'm always flummoxed. Like, I don't know. What do you mean? What are you talking about? But that's my own, like, maybe it's just a neurological defect. Broadly speaking, I really like painting and drawing, so we can go there. Then I do tend towards certain kinds of, like, if we were going to say subject matter, like figurative subject matter. But that still leaves in acres of things I'm not at all interested in. And differentiating it comes down to sort of sensibilities and individual artists. I like things I like things that are clearly personal and functioning on their own terms. And I like paintings in particular to function as objects, not just as an image. Yeah. So, one might think that would disallow, let's say, Carl Wersum or something, but actually when you see those in person, they're incredible as painted objects. They have presence. But I love Gorky and Mata, Motherwell, all sorts of things. I love Saul DeWitt. I'm interested in experiencing things, and a lot of the artwork I'm attracted to is giving new information, either physically in its facture, or in the image it's presenting, or ideally both, which is where you get artists, some of my favorite artists like Carol Dunham or Robert Gober, of course, Gary Panter. Just like looking around my little hovel here in Danish Schatz. People that are expanding the language of what can be done in let's say, in this case, painting, but also making things that are personal in a language that they've more or less invented. So that's like the complex arithmetic, I guess, that it takes for me to get really excited about something.
Well, it makes me
just, yeah, go ahead.
It makes me wonder if that art of, like, there's kind of this overlaying of art history onto things that really doesn't function when the artist themselves is considered. In fact, there's so many artists who say, I'm not part of that movement. Some random critic said this ism at some point and laid it on me. Yeah, I don't associate with these people at all. I don't agree with them in any sense. And so when I consider that you're trying to kind of make this alternate history, it's interesting that maybe the way you're doing it is via a different process entirely, as opposed to trying to reduce it down to these groups that kind of suit a very simple narrative, often a political or narrative,
No, I'm trying to trace sensibilities more than I am groups. So, I mean, the show that I probably got the most attention for was this thing called What Nerve, which is at the RISD Museum and then at Matthew Marks Gallery in New York. And that was really about tracing a sensibility from
from Chicago to Northern California to Providence to Ann Arbor, and finding these artists who are all shared a certain disdain for orthodoxies and for movements, and but and we're also all interested in kind of stretching what was possible for embodied forms, and just sort of making art that's really, really retinal, that really, really needs to be seen in person. And that, you know, it's a tricky, you can't really build a proper history that way, but you can point to this sensibility that runs through all of them and say, hey, look over there. Now let's think about what Jim Nutt is doing in 1966, and think about how that relates to what Rosenquist is doing at the same time. And let's think about that. Let's think about ways to, like, I'm not looking to, like, I wasn't looking to replace a canon so much as enlarge it, and help elucidate why some things got more attention than others, or things like that. I mean, I think one of the things I do believe in with institutions is that they offer a huge amount of support financially and scholarly, of course. And that is something I'm not that cynical about. And I, just because I know the difference it's made to me, and I know the difference it's made to a lot of artists. So, you know, if I could get, let's say, I mean, this isn't a real example, but let's say if I get the Whitney interested in Panther, let's say, then that triggers a lot of that triggers a lot of discussion in an institution, amongst other institutions, amongst scholars. There's a ripple effect. And if you want this work to live for a long time and not have to be continually rediscovered, let's say, then institutions are a good thing to think about, as flawed as they are, you know.
You're right. So it'd be fair to say you don't think museums are mausoleums, per se.
I don't, because I've worked in them.
Museums?
Yeah, and I know that they're not. And I'm as cynical as the next guy, or maybe more so, but...
Well, they might become this, I mean, just a frame in the future. Like, again, if there's so much visual ephemera that people are so baffled and lost because they might not have the literacy to understand how to navigate it, they might just become a place where you can kind of experience a reduced amount of noise.
That's a funny idea. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of horrifying, but I think it might... It's almost flipped, right? Like before, I feel like it would have been a concentration and a place where you could go to see it all at once. But I feel like it might be the opposite once everything is just hyper-saturated.
I think you might be right. I mean, already I find museums really peaceful, like extremely relaxing to be in. And it is partly that suddenly there's a noise reduction. And you're given a set group of things to focus on. They're not constantly changing as you look at them. It's, it can be a relief. It's true.
Do you understand at this moment what alternative would mean in this year, right? So the term alternative is used in the what nerve, alternative figures in American art, 1960 to the present. Yeah. Is it clear to you what...
No.
Okay, good. Yeah. It's not. No.
No, because since I did that project, art history has gotten so, it's like the soil of art history has just been turned again and again and again and again. There's just been this massive push, just coincidentally. I think I was just part of a zeitgeist of people looking harder at art history and through different lenses. I mean, the most obvious lens being ethnicity and race, and that has shifted things radically over the last decade. I mean, really in the last 5 years, but no, I don't know what alternative means. I barely know what alternative comics mean, let alone underground comics. I mean, I can point to it, I suppose, if you forced me, but even then, I'm not so sure. Like, there's all this stuff happening in New York right now that I'm sure you're aware of.
I'm not.
Oh, maybe not.
No, I've completely kind of like, I don't know. For me, part of, I mean, I live in New Jersey.
Turning
right?
into an old man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think I was born that
old.
A little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I had my time where I cared. And then it's really refreshing to kind of experience that shift. You know, I'm only 35, but like, I think there's a big difference between 25 and 35 in respect to how you interact with a scene like that. And for better or for worse, I just don't even really think about those eyes, those peers in the same way. I think there's pros and cons to that, frankly. But obviously COVID kind of ruined the whole ability for like a physical scene and convention. So that's certainly an element. But yeah, it just feels like everyone is an island increasingly so. And so these threads are a little harder to draw, except when it's like how you're doing it, where it's, like you said, sensibilities, but it isn't about these relative relational things where it's like, oh, this is a countercultural position or this is a relative position. It's more about the work. That's what I would prefer. That it's just, is this work, does it have integrity and is it good regardless of its position?
Good question. I wonder.
I don't know if I asked a question or if I just rambled.
I don't know if you asked a question. It was sort of a question.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess I still try to keep up for some reason, but not in any way that I actually want to. I can't imagine going to Mocha, let's say, or something like that. It's just too nerve-wracking or something. I don't want to do that. But
would you ever publish again? Would you ever go back to that picture box format?
I don't know. There's been a couple times I've thought about it, but it is hard to imagine. It's funny because now it's easier.
Yeah.
Like, certainly, like, e-commerce is so... I can't believe I just used the word e-commerce. E-commerce is... Selling things online is much easier. And I think even finding fulfillment companies is probably a little easier. But I don't know why I would. It would take something pretty special for me to want to do that. Like, I'm really enjoying getting to just think and write without having to worry about, oh my God, I printed 1,000, we've only sold 100. It's just a level of anxiety I'm not sure I'd want to embrace again, but it could happen. It could happen. But if it did, it would have to be, I'd have to have a partner or something. I wouldn't want to do it alone again. I would want somebody to talk to.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It seems to me that when you put in the hard work for a decade or so, you achieve a kind of smoothness or gracefulness that allows you to navigate your craft in what feels like an easier manner at times. Sometimes I'm like skeptical, even from a drawing perspective, like, is this easy because I'm being lazy or because I've earned the right for this moment to be easy? And I don't think I'll ever go back to making what I was making in my 20s. And I can imagine that it would be similar for you. Like, you put in that time. It was kind of the seed of what you're doing now. And there's a scale to what you're doing that makes a lot of sense to me. That's why it's exciting to see that I'm assuming this Lucas Museum is going to be very large. And it's cool that you can work at it from the beginning. So you have a clear imprint. That seems like a very beautiful result. And kind of surprising in some ways, only because Lucas has a hero to villain arc, and maybe to hero again. I don't know. Depends on one's perspective. I love Star Wars so much that I'm very forgiving. I think he's been given a great gift by Disney as they butchered his work so much so that even his prequels kind of become watchable in some strange way. You don't have to make a comment about this, obviously.
I got nothing.
But what can you imagine where these things might end up? Like, in some sense, is a museum a ceiling in a way? Like, it's kind of okay, good. But can you imagine where it might end up? Like, what is is there an ambition?
I might end up. I don't really. Yeah, it's funny. No, I don't know. But I know that. I mean, what I know is that I want to write another book after this one, and I might know what I want to write about. And I'm not. And beyond that, I've been very, very lucky. Like, things have flowed from one. I mean, there's been downswings and all sorts of shit, but mostly work-wise, things have flowed from one thing to another. And yeah, it's not the ceiling. It's I'm still not quite sure what I want to do. If that makes it sounds weird, like I'm doing things. I'm doing the things I want to do, but I would like to write another book, and maybe that will be what I end up doing. I don't know. I mean, for now, I know what the next few years look like. And that feels like enough.
You know what
And I'm really a sort of weirdly, not, I'm a, person for, but really only for being able to do what I want, so which often involves other people, but just being able to do that is probably the goal. If that makes sense, and what I want is might change over time.
I think I understand that in a sense. You work very hard, maybe with others and with institutions, so that you might free up time to truly work and resources to follow these impulses that are
exactly right.
Frankly, if one were to live based on these impulses alone, it probably wouldn't pan out that great. I don't think. I think it's good to have a mix of these things.
Yeah. Yeah, there has to be a mix. For me, it's also just the way I was brought up, and I have to have the mix. I can't. I've tried to do just the one thing, and it just goes. It sort of doesn't function as well for me. In either direction. So like as crazy making as balancing three different things is. It's kind of the only way I'm happy.
No, I completely relate.
Work wise, yeah, you know the deal. It's funny that way. Where in New Jersey are you? I can't remember.
I live in Rutherford, New Jersey, but I was born in Wayne, New Jersey. Rutherford's like 20 from Manhattan.
Is that close?
Yeah, and one of the things I'm working on is an art center that's 102 years old, and I'm tasked with running it. It's a long story, but it's why I'm actually very curious in some of what we're talking about here, because I went to art school, and I kind of put on like this anti-institutional thing at the time, despite being in the school. Yeah. And I always noticed that artists don't... How do I word this? It's very much impossible, I think, to consciously create a thing that attracts a bunch of artists to it, like a kind of inorganic process of making, like this idea of making artists, I think, is strange. But I'm trying to run a center, an art center, that genuinely does that. And I don't even know if it's possible, but every time I interview an artist, they're like, oh, I always felt like I was on the outside of something, or I'm on the outside of, even categorically speaking. Yeah, and that's the kind of artist I'm interested in. I'm sure you are as well. I'm not interested. Yeah. I think there's, what would you say? They're like, there's people who are like signposts. They're not artists, but they look like artists, but they tell you what the center of something is, whether a genre or a movement. And they're usually not the most interesting of that movement. But then the real ones are kind of uncomfortably orbiting that cartoonish figure. And for me, trying to run an institution is like, how could you possibly attract? Because I'm in New Jersey, right? I can't rely on pre-existing artists effectively. Like, they say they're out here. I don't know where they're at, but they often leave to go to New York or Philly. Yeah. And so this problem of, even I'm sure from publishing, it's similar, but the physicality of the space is, as an institution, is what I'm grappling with.
Yeah, God. It's an educational space as well, or a studio space, or exhibition space, or all of the above?
It's kind of all of them, but it's kind of being revivified out of this kind of paltry community center energy that's been foisted upon it. And I can go into how I feel about the word community, but it's a complicated one. And so it's just interesting. It's not a museum, you know, so I find it interesting, like these different emphases on entertainment or education or consumption or production. I would really like it to be a place of production and appreciation, not just consumption. And like, you know, music shows are great, but I definitely want to transcend that dynamic. There's already so much consumption, you know?
Yeah. But then if it's not, that's interesting.
But there's money to figure out. Like, I don't know how to feel about funding from the state, if I'm being honest, and maybe you've encountered this yourself. I guess I'm like a little cynical or suspicious. There's always some string attached. There's always some hook. And if it's not, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah. Absolutely. I mean, most of it's, you're never going to like where it's coming from. Not really. So it's part of the deal. It's like, it's a little bit of the deal we make to get to do what we want.
Oh yes. People make far worse deals. Yeah.
I'm okay with that deal. I mean, I know some people aren't. That's okay too.
Right.
It's just, this is late capitalism. So it is what it is.
Is there a particular artist you think of that in comics that you think is brutally overlooked?
Oh.
Unjustly overlooked. Even in this day and age.
Jeez. God, everything is so pretty well attended to. I mean, if I was going to, like, what's my wish list?
I'm just curious. Do you have people you're like, all right, this person needs to get out there?
I mean, I would love to see a Bungle Family series of books. That would be a lot of fun.
Harry, did you say Bungle?
Bungle Family was this comic strip by Harry Tuthill from the 20s and 30s. I love that strip. I still think, you know, is been poorly served by reprints is both is Milkrose still, although there's a great book of the Sunday comics out now. So maybe that's not true. But overlooked, Booty Rogers, I think, is still overlooked. There was one book that came out, but that was it. But there's not, I'm sure somebody will come to me later. But God, I mean, things are the last 10, 15 years. It's unbelievable the amount of reprints that have come out. You can't even keep up. So I feel like most stuff is pretty well served.
Does that inspire you, or how do I say this? Like, sometimes there's something cool about...
Is it a buzzkill?
Yeah.
No, it's not.
Okay.
No, I've never like gotten off on knowing a secret. That doesn't float my boat, really.
That's healthy.
It might be. No, there's most stuff. It's amazing what's come out.
I still root around sometimes, and I'm like, well, it's an ambivalent feeling, because I find like a 1920s French illustrator who I think is amazing and no one cares about. But then, and then I'm like, well, this could happen to, and it does happen to very good artists, great artists, but somehow I have found it simultaneously, and that's very exciting. That's like a weird demand, dopamine wise I think, to trying to find all these obscure things, but it seems to be infinite, and I don't know how that's possible. I don't know, I don't mean to go down this again, but I'm just gonna get more and more increasingly like, is this a real art? Like, in 10 years I feel like the internet's gonna be like, is this a real artist or some like chimera of... It's gonna be super, super weird. That's why books are... I'm not selling. I was gonna sell a bunch of my books, and then I was like, I'm not gonna do that. I'm going to keep them.
If you have the space, keep them. Yeah, I gotta say, I sold a bunch of my books, and I still regret it. It's so silly. It does feel infinite. I mean, not necessarily. I don't know that the artists that you can go deep on are infinite. Mm-hmm. But at any given time, I feel like you can stumble over some book that somebody made that's just great. And that might be all they did, or everything else might suck, or whatever. But it feels infinite because print culture was sort of more enormous than we can really conceive of. 100 years ago, 50 years ago, it was just a different order of magnitude. And so, there's always, but I love tripping over things now, and then I might get obsessive over something, but lucky for me, my urge to then like, my mania, like to then somehow get it into print has subsided.
So, oh, it has a bit. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That urge has, I still have it, but it's not as pressing as it was. That's for sure. Like, there's so much out there that it doesn't feel as pressing. There's just a plethora of material coming out all the time, old and new, and a lot of, and just so much old stuff. God, it's hard to keep up with it all. It's impossible. And it's interesting because it's kind of blown out any notion of a rationale for something being reprinted. Like, you used to just think, okay, this is being reprinted because it's awesome, it's essential. And now you're like, this is being reprinted because one guy thought it was cool.
Yeah.
So it changes, and it makes, and that's fine. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's fine. I don't know. Seems fine.
Yeah. Well, I think we're good.
We're good?
You got anything on your mind? Anything you want to tell the people?
I love Reginald Marsh these days. You ever look at Reginald Marsh? He was like an Ashcan school guy, but made pretty great paintings and drawings.
No, you're on a whole nother level. I don't know who this dude is. It looks like
It's great.
Looks like Paul Cadman?
Yeah.
A bit. Is he with those boys?
Different boys, but similar, but overlapping boys. Yeah.
Jared. What's his name?
Jared French.
Yeah.
No, this is a little more like social realism than that stuff, but it's similarly neglected, let's say. So it's pretty great. Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, good to talk to you. Thanks for asking me to do this.
Yeah, nice, for sure.
Nice to think about this stuff. All right, man.
Thank you for your time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Music by Dori Bavarsky and Mingjie Chen. Next up, we have Margot Farrick. Enjoy your week.